He didn't make plans himself any more. There was now, and it was followed by another now, if you were lucky.
"What a fine Buddhist monk you would make," Ursula said.
"If you look at the percentage loss," Ursula's girl from the Air Ministry said, sipping primly on a pink gin,
"then, mathematically speaking, death is inevitable."
There were other ways of looking at the figures, she added hastily, when Ursula glared at her. Teddy met her when he was on leave the following May. The three of them went for a drink together, and then on to dancing at the Hammersmith Palais. Teddy didn't enjoy himself. He had the uncomfortable feeling that every time the girl from the Air Ministry looked at him, she was seeing a set of actuarial tables. Did Nancy know the cold calculus of death in Bomber Command? Probably not. She was cocooned somewhere in the clinical safety of an intellectual post. She was trying to make arrangements to see him in London as soon as the tour finished. She had written, "Perhaps I could come to your colleague's wedding. Can you wangle an invitation, or are girlfriends considered surplus to requirements?" The tone of this letter felt all wrong to him. The unfortunate use of the word colleague, for one. Vic Bennett wasn't a colleague. He was part of Teddy, like an arm or a leg. He was a pal, a mate, a comrade. If civilization survived, and it was currently hanging in the balance, would it be as a society of equals? A new Jerusalem full of levellers and diggers? And it wasn't just the RAF, surely, where class barriers had broken down as everyone was forced to muck in together. Teddy rubbed shoulders with men and women. He would never have come across in a world of public school, Oxbridge, banking. He might be their captain. He might be responsible for them. But he wasn't their superior. He had burnt Nancy's letter in the stove in his heart. They were always short of fuel.
4 minutes to target, Skipper.
Okay, Navigator.
4 minutes to target, Bomb Emma.
Okay, Skipper.
That ruddy port inner's still not happy, Skipper,
Norman Best said. The light on the fuel pressure gauge had been flicking on and off for the whole flight, seemingly living a life of its own. It was the same engine that had delayed their takeoff, and Norman had been monitoring it suspiciously for some time now. It was just as well they'd been late getting off, Vic Bennett said. He, of all people, had somehow or other managed to forget his good luck charm, and had persuaded the WAF driver who had brought them out to dispersal to race him back to the crew room to retrieve this item, while the ground crew worked on the misbehaving engine. They were the unsung heroes of the Spanner Brigade, the riggers and fitters and mechanics. NCOs or lowly irks, they worked all day and night in every kind of weather. They waved them off when they left, and greeted them when they returned. They might stay out all night in their huts on bleak dispersals, waiting for their aircraft to return safely. No good luck charms for them, just civil handshakes all round on departure and, "See you in the morning, then." Vic Bennett's own particular fetish was a pair of red satin knickers belonging to his fiancée, the aforesaid Lil. These unmentionables, as Vic called them, were carried neatly folded in the pocket of his battle dress on every trip.
"If we make it to his wedding," Keith said, "I know what we'll all be thinking about when the blushing bride walks down the aisle."
"It'll be me that's blushing," Kenny Nielsen said.
Luck was everything.
"No lady," according to Keith. "Just a bloody tart."
Superstition was rampant on the station. Everyone in the squadron seemed to have their own voodoo. A lock of hair, a St. Christopher, a playing card, the ubiquitous rabbit foot. There was a flight sergeant who always sang La Donne Mobile in the crew room when they were getting dressed in their flying clothes, and another who had to put his left boot on before his right. If he forgot, he had to take all his kit off and start again. He survived the war. The flight sergeant who sang La Donna Immobile did not, nor the other hundreds with their weird rites and sacraments. The dead were legion, and the gods had their own secret agenda. Keith did not have a mascot, claiming that his whole family was Widdershins, their luck back to front, and he could probably have walked under a ladder with a dozen black cats crossing in front of him, and he would be just fine. His convict antecedents were Irish gypsies, deported to Australia for vagrancy. "Not proper gypsies, probably," he said. "Rives and tramps, I expect." Kenny Nielsen was the youngest in a family of 10, the Bairn, and his lucky mascot was a shabby little black cat, just the one, made of pieces of felt sewn together rather ham-fistedly by one of his many nieces. It was a deplorable creature that looked as if it had spent most of its life in the mouth of a dog. And yes, Teddy's Juju was the silver hair that Ursula had given him, which he had initially treated with careless disregard, but which now flew every op, cradled snugly in his battle-dress pocket, lodged above his heart. He had unconsciously developed his own ritual, touching the hair like a relic before takeoff and after landing, a silent prayer and thank you. Not that he could feel the little inanimate creature through the thick layers of his sheepskin flying jacket and Mae West, but he knew it was there, silently doing its best to keep him safe. They mooched morosely around as they waited for the WAF to bring Vic back. George Carr ate his chocolate ration as usual. Everyone else saved theirs for later. But George reasoned that he might die during the raid and never get to enjoy it. Chocolate had been in short supply in his Lancashire childhood, he said. They smoked their last cigarette for the next 6 hours or so, emptied their bladders against S. Sugar's tail, and stared glumly at the ground. Even their normally chirpy little Scott was silenced. The poor second Dickie was beginning to look as if he was on the way to his execution. "Are they always like this?" he muttered to Teddy. And Teddy, who could hardly say to the poor boy, "They think they're for the chop tonight," instead betrayed the collective character of his crew and said, "No, they're just a miserable bunch of so-and-sos." That morning, Teddy had received a letter from Ursula. Inconsequential stuff, but at the end she had written, "How are you?" And the emotion compressed into those three laconic monosyllables seemed to rise off the page and unfold into something so much larger and more heartfelt. "All is well here," he wrote back, with equal compression. "Don't worry about me," he added, giving her the reassuring gift of a dissyllable. He asked a WAF, a parachute packer called Nellie Jordan, who was sweet on him, to post the letter. The WAFs were all sweet on Teddy. He suspected this was simply because he had been around longer than most crew members. It was a letter to be sent, not one to be kept in his locker in the event of him not coming back. Teddy had three of those, one for his mother, one for Ursula, one for Nancy. They all said much the same thing, that he loved them, and that they mustn't mourn him too much, because he died doing something he believed in, and they should get on with their lives, because that was what he would want. And so on. He didn't think this one-sided final correspondence was a place for soul-searching, or philosophical introspection, or for truth, for that matter. It had felt strange to write about himself in a future where he didn't exist, a kind of metaphysical conundrum. If he were to die, someone from the Committee of Adjustment, a ridiculous euphemism, would come and swiftly clear away his kit. Anything that would give a mother or a wife pause for thought, smutty photos, letters to other women, or French letters, would be put in a different bag. Not that Teddy had any indiscretions to hide, none that would leave tangible evidence, anyway. He sometimes wondered what happened to these benevolently censored items. Were they simply thrown away, or was there a store somewhere full of unwanted secrets? He never did find out the answer to this question. The following year, during his second tour, he inadvertently opened the door to a storeroom on the station and found it full of aircrew uniforms on hangers. He thought there must be replacement issue, until he looked more closely and saw the brevets and stripes and ribbon medals, and realized they had come off the bodies of the dead and injured. The empty uniforms would have provided a poetic image, if he hadn't more or less relinquished poetry by then. Sometimes, when a new crew arrived at a station, they found that the belongings of the previous occupants of their Nissen huts were still strewn around the place, as if they were about to walk back in. The committee of adjustment would shoo them out while they cleared up, packing away the dead crew's belongings as WAFs or orderlies stripped the beds and made them up anew. And sometimes those same sprogs would go up on a sortie that night and not come back, and never even sleep in those newly made beds. They could come and go without anyone even knowing who they were, their names written on water, or scorched into the earth, or atomized into the air. Legion. Vic Bennett arrived back, bearing aloft the unmentionables.
"And yet mentioned so often," Max said sardonically,
and they climbed into S. Sugar, J-Jig's replacement. J-Jig had been an unwieldy beast. Like a lot of the Mark IIs, she had seemed reluctant to leave the ground. If she'd been a horse, she would be the kind that you had to encourage to start the race, let alone finish. And if you hadn't known about her, if you hadn't been warned about her foibles, particularly her suicidal desire to swerve to the right, then it could have been the end of you before you had even begun. Tonight was only the second op they had flown in S. Sugar. It was a new kite, straight from the factory floor, as fresh as her crew had once been. They had all wanted to finish their tour in J-Jig, already an object of fond reminiscence. She had brought them luck, she had kept them safe, and they were still resentful at her loss, and convinced it was yet another sign that they weren't going to make it to 30. She had had 26 bombs stenciled on her fuselage, one for every mission flown, a key for her 21st mission, and an ice cream cornet that some joker had given her for a raid on Italy. S. Sugar's only op so far, to Dusseldorf, hadn't yet been commemorated, and despite her newness, none of them trusted her. The overheating port engine was just one of many niggles. Their CO had hitched a ride out to dispersal with Vic, and was fretting now at the time.
10 minutes, he said, tapping his watch.
10 minutes to get off, or they would be out of time, and would have to be scrubbed. The truck with the WAF and the CO aboard followed them along the perimeter track and parked by the flying control caravan, where they climbed out and joined a rather ragged-looking farewell party that was waiting patiently to wave them off. Teddy suspected some of them had given up hope that they were ever going to go and had abandoned them. They lumbered along the runway, everyone waving enthusiastically at them, particularly the CO, who made a point of always being there at every takeoff, and often gave the impression that he believed that if he waved vigorously enough, with both arms aloft, running along the flare path beside them, he would help them lift their wheels successfully and drag their full bellies of bombs into the air. Crashing on takeoff accounted for so much loss of life that it was always a moment of supreme reprieve for Teddy when he had managed to haul the Halifax off the concrete and above the hedges and trees. If you turned back from the target, and it happened all the time because of weather or technical problems with the aircraft, then those runs also didn't count as an op, no matter how hair-raising.
"Bloody unfair," Teddy said.
"Iniquitous, old chip,"
Keith said in an atrocious attempt at a posh English accent. They were uproariously drunk at the time, on the 48-hour stand-down after Turin. They should have turned back from Turin, Teddy realized that now, but he was one of those pilots who pressed on. Some didn't. The first time they ever turned back, only their second sortie, was because their starboard engine started leaking coolant over the North Sea, and then the Sparks intercom packed up, and so Teddy made what he thought was the sensible decision to turn for home, jettisoning their bombs harmlessly into the North Sea. Their CO, a different one from now, wasn't impressed. He frowned upon early returns, and he interrogated them for a long time about why they had thought they shouldn't press on to the target. Teddy thought it was fairly obvious why. The engine was going to overheat and catch fire. In those early days, they were less sanguine about such things, and they needed to be able to communicate with the spark.
"Do you?" the CO said. "In an extremity, you would manage, surely. And a good pilot wouldn't think twice about flying on only three engines."
It was then that Teddy realized that they were not so much warriors as sacrifices for the greater good. Birds thrown against a wall, in the hope that eventually, if there were enough birds, they would break that wall. Statistics in one of Morrissey's great War Office ledgers.
"What a pompous ass he has become," Ursula wrote crossly.
And that was when Teddy resolved that he would not have their courage questioned again. They would not be Harris's weaker brethren, but would press on to the target every time, unless it was absolutely impossible. But that he would also do everything he could to keep them all alive. Over the rest of the first tour, whenever they weren't on ops, he had them constantly doing parachute and ditching drills. Unrealistic, perhaps, with neither air nor water to practice with. But if they knew what to do, if it literally was drilled into them, then they would, might, beat those overshadowing odds. When they had first crewed up at the OTU, Vic and Kenny had done more air gunnery practice than anyone else. They had gone on dummy bombing runs to Immingham Harbour and done countless fighter affiliation exercises, practicing evasive manoeuvres. Teddy still took them up on as many cross-country exercises as he could, and did fighter affiliation with the Spitfires from the nearest fighter station. He coached the whole crew into being proficient in Morse code, and having an understanding of each other's jobs, so that in that unsympathetic CO's extremity, they might be able to understudy for one another. In theory, Keith, who had trained initially as a pilot, would be the best person to take over if something happened to Teddy. But Teddy had also trained Norman Best in the rudimentaries of flying,
because that bloody Aussie Shearer might be able to fly the kite, but he won't be able to land the bloody thing.
Teddy swore a lot these days. Blasphemy was infectious. But he still tried to avoid the worst words. Of course, if something happened to Teddy, they were probably all doomed already anyway. Teddy knew that Mac always worked out the route to the nearest neutral territory, Switzerland or Sweden or Portugal, and whenever it was a clear night, he would hone his astro-navigational skills. And the shy and retiring Norman Best wore an entire set of French clothing, right down to the underwear, beneath his battle dress, the clothes acquired in Paris when he was a student. An authentic French beret in his pocket, too. A Boy Scout, if ever there was one, Teddy thought.
"Be prepared in mind by having thought out beforehand any accident or situation that might occur."
Somehow it seemed unlikely that his own Kibbo Kift training with a bow and arrow was going to be much of a help if he was on the run in France. Norman did bail out over France, as it happened, flying with another crew on a second tour of duty in 43. But his preparation for evading was all for naught, as his parachute was already on fire when he exited the aircraft, and he fell to earth like a fiery plumbob. His body never recovered. Norman carried no good luck charm, had no compulsive right like George Carr, who had to turn round three times to the right, like a dog settling, before entering the aircraft, and thought that no one noticed. The wretched second dickie stood next to Teddy for takeoff. He was called Guy, an old Etonian, he said, hoping to form some kind of bond with Teddy.
"I didn't go to Eton," Teddy said rather dismissively.
Guy had a lot to learn, if he lived long enough.
"What a mug," Vic said.
Of course, he wasn't the first second dickie they had carried, and they had flown with a couple of obbods when various members of the crew hadn't been able to go on ops. George Carr had been given leave to go to his father's funeral. Mac had missed an op because of stomach flu, and Kenny had a sprained ankle that put him out of action for a raid on Bremen. the result of one of Teddy's parachute drills. Vic Bennett had missed J-Jig's final eventful op to Turin last week because of a debilitating cold. Mac had made up his numbers flying with another crew, but that still left both their gunners an op short of a full tour. They would have to fly as oddbods in someone else's crew. Unlucky mascots. On the Turin raid, they had flown with a replacement air gunner in Vic's position in the mid-upper turret. He had a soft West Country burr, Zomerzet, and spoke no more than a few words on the whole trip. They had flown over the snowy peaks of the Alps by the light of a brightly full moon.
"Not many people have seen that, eh, Skipper?"
Kenny Nielsen piped up on the intercom. Even Mac came out from behind his curtain to
take in the view. "Almost as good as the Rockies," he said.
And Kenny said,
"Aye, but you haven't seen the Rockies from above, have you?"
And Keith started muttering something about the Blue Mountains, until Teddy said,
"Okay, everyone,"
before a full-blown discussion about the relative merits of the world's mountain ranges took hold. The Obbod had nothing to say about mountains. Teddy supposed they didn't have many in Somerset. Apart from a few seaside holidays in Cornwall when they were children, the Southwest was not a part of the country that he had explored. If he survived the war, he thought, he would rather like to go on a grand tour of England, all the highways and byways, the hidden villages, the grand monuments, the meadows, moors and lakes. Everything they were fighting for.
"They were privileged," Norman said, "to see the world in a way that few people ever had.
A privilege they were paying a terrible price for," Teddy thought. They had been awestruck not only at the sight of the Alps by moonlight, but by the depthless, inky black skies, pricked with thousands upon thousands of stars. Bright seed broadcast by some generous god, Teddy thought, drifting dangerously close to the forsaken realm of poetry. There were sunsets and dawns of thrilling grandeur, and once, on a run to Bochum, a spectacular show that the Northern Lights put on for them, a vibrating curtain of colours draped in the sky that had left them searching for superlatives. In his isolated position at the back, Kenny Nielsen claimed that he had
the best seat in the house.
Sunsets in particular left him wonderstruck. From the tail of the aircraft, he could see the sun going down long after the rest of the crew had flown into the darkness.
"The sky's on fire,"
he reported excitedly one time, after Teddy had lugged the Halifax off the runway and into the air. Teddy had a moment of terror, a vision of Armageddon being wreaked on them by the enemy. But then Vic Bennett in the mid-upper turret said,
"That's the best sunset I've ever seen." "I like gods painted the sky," Kenny said.
And Teddy said, "Can we have some peace and quiet?" Relieved that the end of the world was not nigh, and shocked at himself for having thought that it might be.
"It is, bro,"
Kenny persisted, not quite able to let the beauty go. Or,
"beauty,"
as Sylvie might have said. As a rear gunner, Kenny was the least likely of all of them to live to see a sunset in peacetime. Only a 1 in 4 chance of staying alive until then, Ursula's girl said. In the end, of course, it was the girl from the Air Ministry who was living without a future, killed by the Orbwich V-1 rocket in June of 44. She had been on the roof of Adastral House, where the Air Ministry was housed, sunbathing whilst eating her lunchtime sandwiches. What were the odds against that? Teddy wondered. Other Air Ministry girls were sucked out of the shattered windows of the building and fell to their deaths in the street. One man was sliced in half by a sheet of falling glass, Ursula said. Teddy supposed, for some people, Ursula was a girl, too. The girl from Civil Defence. She was called Anne, the girl from the Air Ministry. And when they parted at the end of the evening they had spent in each other's company at the Hammersmith Palais, she danced a neat foxtrot. She said to Teddy, "Well, good luck," and didn't look him in the eye. There hadn't been much in the way of flak on the run-in to Turin. The Italian AK-AK guns always seemed half-hearted. They bombed the target from 16,000 feet on the red markers. The weather had started to close in on the approach. The Alps were no longer beautiful, no longer visible, in fact. And as they turned for home, they found themselves confronted by a huge dark tower of cumulus looming high above them. Inside this monster there were flashes and sparks, as if small explosions were going off, and at first they thought it must be something to do with the bombing, or even some new kind of weapon that was being tried out on them. And it took a few moments before they understood that they were flying into an enormous, sinister thunderhead. The turbulence was atrocious, rocking J-Jig around as if it were a toy aircraft, as flies to wanton boys, or wanton gods, Zeus throwing his thunderbolts, Thor wielding his hammer, the fairies moving their furniture, Bridget used to say, a less vengeful interpretation for a kinder time. Some fairies, Teddy thought. On the intercom, he could hear the curses ranging from Norman's terrified Christian restraint, "Oh, dear Lord," to Keith's bitter, "Fuck, fuck, fuck, get us the fuck out of this, Skip." They were all agreed afterwards that it was worse than any flak they had ever encountered. Flak, they understood. But this was something more primeval. Occasionally, the lightning illuminated malevolent fissures and caverns within the dark mass. The turbulent air currents were random, bucking and bucketing them up and down or sideways. And Teddy wondered if the aircraft might simply break up from stress. The outside temperature dropped dramatically, and ice started to form on the wings. Ice was a fierce enemy. It could appear rapidly and sometimes without warning, several tons of it, freezing the engines and the controls, and covering the wings in thick white slabs. It could make an aircraft so heavy that it simply fell out of the sky or broke into pieces in the air. The intercom was alive now with involuntary Jesuses and Christs and fucks as they were thrown around, and too, the murmur of Psalm 23, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," which was interrupted by several gasps of astonishment as J-Jig was abruptly ejected from the Thunderhead, only to find herself possessed by a phantom. Touched everywhere by St. Elmo's fire, bright blue and unearthly, an eerie luminescence that flared along the edges of the wings and even whirled round with the propellers, spinning off them and making strange feathery trails in the darkness, like ghostly Catherine wheels. It was dancing between the tips of his guns, Kenny reported from the rear.
"Up here, too,"
from the mid-upper. The strange phenomenon made Teddy think of the Willies in Giselle. He had seen a performance of the ballet when he was at school, a trip to the Royal Opera House organized by the music master. The dancers had been lit by the same rather sinister and otherworldly blue light that was now attracted to J-Jig. Looking back, it had been an odd choice for a class of boisterous 13-year-old public schoolboys. His father, when told, had raised an eyebrow and asked the master's name.
"An admirer of Wilde, I expect."
And even Sylvie, with her love of art, had questioned them being exposed to this rather fey choice, as she put it, when usually the only time they left the school grounds was to go to an away rugby match. Afterwards, Teddy had nightmares, dreaming that the spectral women had their hands on him and were trying to drag him down into some dark, unknown place. The blue fire finally flickered and died, and the starboard outer engine began to start and stutter with vibration before running wild. Teddy had just feathered it when the troublesome port inner also began to vibrate. It sounded as if it was going to shake itself free from the aircraft altogether. They would probably be better off without it. Teddy told Mac to draw up a new flight plan that would take them the quickest way home. The storm had left their magnetic instruments useless, and Mac had to use dead reckoning to plot a new course, but not before the port inner decided to catch fire.
"Give me a break," Teddy thought,
pushing the throttles forward to take them into a steep dive. "Hang on, everyone!" that had the welcome effect of not only extinguishing the flames, but also dislodging the ice on the wings. Every cloud had a silver lining, he thought. Conversely, every silver lining was in a cloud. The starboard outer was now smoking, and a few minutes later Keith reported seeing flames, and then without warning the engine exploded, the force almost flipping the aircraft over. A spate of Jesus Christ's and fucking hells on the intercom, and Teddy said, "It's okay." What a ridiculous thing to say, he thought. They were flying on two engines, fighting a headwind, still icing up, with no wireless and only dead reckoning to get them home. They were not okay at all. Teddy was considering giving the order to abandon the aircraft when something even more alarming happened. Mac started singing. Mac. And not some ditty from the Canadian backwoods, but a cacophonous performance of Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Even allowing for the intercom, it was a pretty dreadful rendition, particularly when he imitated the bugle like an elephant in pain. This was followed, even more shockingly, by their dour Canadian laughing, rather in the manner of Charles Penrose singing The Laughing Policeman. Teddy asked Norman to find out what was happening behind Mac's curtain. It transpired that his oxygen tube had become frozen. Norman tried to defrost it with the coffee from his flask, but the coffee was only lukewarm by now. They dragged Mac out from his seat and managed to hook him up to the central oxygen tank and hope for the best. Hypoxia tended to make you do the oddest things, and then it tended to kill you. After the war, Mac worked for a big insurance company in Toronto. He married and had three children and had taken early retirement.
Made some canny investments.
By the time Teddy met him at a squadron reunion dinner, the only one Teddy ever attended. He hadn't seemed familiar in any way, and it struck Teddy that perhaps he had never really known him. Perhaps he had never known any of them. It had just seemed so because of the circumstances they had found themselves in. The older version of Mac seemed rather self-satisfied to Teddy's eyes. The awfulness of the time they had shared didn't seem to have left a mark on him. He supposed that old men had reminisced about old wars since time began. Jericho, Thermopylae, Nuremberg. He didn't really want to be one of them. Teddy left the reunion early, saying,
"Sorry, I have to give you the chop, chaps."
Slipping back easily into that lingo that people now made fun of. Yet even then, all those years later, he found that in the long dark watches of the night, plagued by insomnia, he would recite those names. Essen, Bremen, Wilhelmshaven, Duisburg, Vegesack, Hamburg, Saarbrücken, Düsseldorf, Osnabrück, Flensburg, Frankfurt, Kassel, Krefeld, Aachen, Genoa, Milan, Turin, Mainz, Karlsruhe, Kiel, Cologne, Gelsenkirchen, Bochum, Stuttgart, Berlin, Nuremberg. Some might count sheep. Teddy counted the towns and cities he had tried to destroy, that had tried to destroy him. Perhaps they had succeeded. On the return from Turin, they were caught by flak as they approached the French coast. An AK-AK shell blasted through the fuselage, almost jolting J-Jig out of the skies. They were flying through thick cloud, and for a disorientating moment, Teddy thought they were flying upside down. The aircraft reeked of cordite, and there was smoke coming from somewhere, although no sign of flames. Teddy did a crew check.
"Everyone okay?"
he asked.
"Rear gunner? Mid-upper? Bomb aimer?"
Teddy always worried most about his rear gunner, stuck out there at the back, far away from them. It surprised him that someone as garrulous and sociable as little Kenny Nielsen was so cheerful in his cold and lonely nest. Teddy knew he couldn't have tolerated that cramped, claustrophobic space. Everyone reported themselves variously, "Okay, fine, still here," and so on. Norman went back to check for damage. Some holes in the fuselage and the lower escape hatch blown off. And the hydraulics must be severed, he said, because he'd been sloshing around in fluid, but there was nothing on fire. They were flying lower and slower with every mile. They were below 5,000 feet and took off their oxygen masks. Mac had rallied by now and lay down on the crew rest. Teddy decided that they couldn't limp on like this much longer and told everyone to prepare to abandon the aircraft. But they were already out over the sea, and they all agreed they would prefer to press on than ditch. Their faith in Teddy's abilities to get them to the target and home again had become unshakable as the tour had progressed. Possibly a misplaced faith, Teddy thought ruefully. By the time the English coast came into view,
"Thank you, Lord,"
he heard Norman say. They were almost running on empty, and there wasn't much more fuel to be coaxed out of the tanks. George had spent the last few hours fixing the wireless and managed to put out a darkey call for an emergency landing, but everywhere seemed to have closed up shop for the night. They were so low over land now that when they flew over a railway line they could see a train snaking below, the red-hot glow from the firebox of the engine escaping from its blackout shields. He didn't fancy their chances of parachuting successfully from this height and told them to assume crash positions, which meant not much more than bracing themselves against anything handy. But then, at the last minute, a coolly competent female voice at Scampton gave them permission to land, and Norman said,
"We can do it, Skipper."
And they did, more, Teddy thought, by wishing it to be so than by any skill on his part. If seven minds working as one could fly an aircraft on willpower alone, then they did. Six minds, it turned out. They didn't quite manage to make it to the runway. Lacking hydraulics, Teddy couldn't use the flaps, and the undercarriage wouldn't come down, so they made a wheels-up landing at 150 miles per hour, overshooting the runway, smashing through the perimeter hedge, careering into a field, bouncing over a road, almost clipping the gable end of a row of farm cottages, before slewing through another hedge and ploughing up a field in which they finally slithered to a juddering, bone-shaking stop. Several of the crew were propelled into the forward bulkhead, so that, bruised and battered, it took them a while to clamber up the ladder out of the upper escape hatch. The aircraft had immediately filled with acrid smoke, and Teddy, standing at the foot of the ladder to shepherd them out, urged them to be
as quick as you can, lads.
He counted them out. Two missing, one of whom was Kenny. No sign of the mid-upper, either. When Teddy finally got out, he could see that the rear turret was still attached, but the rest of the aircraft was pretty much in pieces. J-Jig had left a trail behind her, wheels, wings, engines, fuel tanks, like a wanton woman divesting herself of clothing. What was left of the fuselage was on fire, and he found his dazed crew gathered around the rear turret, where Kenny seemed to be trapped, Keith yelling at him,
"Get out, you stupid bugger!"
Although he clearly couldn't, as the doors of the turret were jammed and wouldn't rotate.
"Oh, ye gods," Teddy thought.
Was there to be no end to this nightmare op? Would it be just one horror followed by another? Yes, he supposed, for wasn't that what war was? The fuselage was burning fiercely now behind Kenny, and Teddy thought with horror of the belts of ammunition that fed the guns, and wondered how long before the fire found them. Kenny was screaming his head off, expletives that later even Keith said he had never heard before. Were they all going to have to watch him burn to death? There was a small panel in the turret where the perspex had been removed to give the rear gunner a clearer view, as well as freezing him half to death. And they began to exhort Kenny to try to climb through this tiny aperture. He had already managed to divest himself of his bulky heated suit, but was still encumbered by uniform. Once, on a trip to the zoo in London, Teddy had seen an octopus squeeze itself through an impossibly small hole, a party trick that the keeper was keen to demonstrate to small boys. But the octopus had not been hampered by a battle-dress jacket and bulky flying boots, and neither was it in possession of a skeleton But if anyone could perform this Houdini-like trick, it was their little rat-like rear gunner. He managed to get his head out and started to wriggle his shoulders through. Teddy imagined it was rather like being born, although he was hazy about the mechanics of that act. Once Kenny had maneuvered his shoulders through the gap, they grabbed hold of him and pulled and pulled, everyone yelling their heads off, until suddenly he simply popped out like a cork from a bottle, or Jonah being vomited up by the whale. But then, to their alarm, instead of immediately jumping down, he disentangled himself from their grasp and reached his head and an arm back through the hole into the turret, emerging triumphantly a second later, bearing aloft one tatty and very lucky black cat. Then they all ran like hell to get away from the remains of the aircraft, which a minute later exploded, bright tongues of white flame licking the dawn sky, thanks to the oxygen bottles, followed by a nasty popping and spattering from the ammunition belts. And that was the end of poor J. Jig, who, workhorse that she was, had carried them to hell and back in her stinking, oily belly.
"She was a good kite," Keith said, performing the eulogy.
She was, they all agreed.
"R.I.P.," Kenny said.
The occupants of the cottages had had a rude awakening, but a nice motherly woman brought out a tray with mugs of tea on it. The farmer appeared and castigated them for destroying his cabbages, and was himself chastised by the motherly woman, by which time a truck from Scampton had pulled up to give them a lift back to the station, where they were given breakfast, and then had to wait for transport back to their own squadron. All they wanted was sleep, and the journey back seemed interminable. Even when they arrived back, they still had to go through the usual routine of reporting to an intelligence officer. They were grey with fatigue, their faces still creased from their oxygen masks, almost deaf from the din of J-Jig's engines. Teddy had a pounding headache, which was usual at the end of a trip. It was almost lunchtime by then, although they were still awarded their customary mugs of tea laced with tots of rum, and the chaplain did the rounds with cigarettes and biscuits, and said,
"Good to see you back, boys."
The ground crew had waited up for them, until they heard from Scampton that they were safe, and the CO hadn't been to sleep at all, and sat in on their debriefing with the intelligence officer. They were his longest-serving crew, and he was paternally fond of them. Turin had been their 28th op. They had landed without the odd bod. They worked out that he must have bailed out pretty sharpish when Teddy first ordered them to abandon J-Jig. That had been over France, hadn't it? Or over the North Sea? Teddy was so tired he could barely remember his own name, let alone the finer details of the harrowing return. He certainly couldn't remember the odd bod's name.
"Fred, I think," George Carr said.
"Frank, according to Norman."
"Definitely something beginning with an F," they agreed.
And the intelligence officer had to riffle through her paperwork before saying,
"An H, actually. Harold Wilkinson."
"Close,"
George Carr said. Mac had no memory at all of the anoxia. Said he didn't even know the words to Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, although they never stopped singing it to him on the crew binge that followed Turin. They had 48 hours leave, and they slept for half of that, and then got blind drunk in Betty's bar in York for the other half. After the war, a long time after the war, Teddy did a bit of investigating to see if he could find out what happened to the odd bod. There were no reports of him parachuting successfully, of evading or of being taken prisoner. He was one of the missing, and eventually his name appeared on the Runnymede Memorial for the men who had no known grave, where he was remembered as Harold Wilkinson, not the odd bod.
"Silly clot," Vic Bennett said.
"He should have had more faith in his pilot, shouldn't he? Can't believe I miss the excitement."
They weren't as late returning as the crew of A. Abel, who had been on the same raid as them to Turin, but but had diverted on the way home to Algiers when two of their engines were knocked out. They had been posted as officially missing by the time they got back to the station. Their Halifax, much to everyone's delight, was loaded down with crates of oranges which were distributed around the squadron, some going to the local primary school. Teddy ate his orange very slowly, savouring every segment, and thinking about hot slices of Mediterranean sun he never expected to see again. He didn't. After the war, Teddy never went abroad again, never took a foreign holiday, never stepped on board a modern aircraft, or took a boat on the sea. Varla told him that this isolationist policy was pathetic, and he said it wasn't a policy, it was just the way things had happened. Nor was it jingoistic and xenophobic, another two words in her arsenal. She accused him of having no sense of adventure, and he thought that the war had provided enough adventure for several lifetimes, and a man could nurture himself just as well in his own garden.
Il faut cultiver notre jardin,
he said to her, but she had never heard of Candide. He wasn't sure she'd even heard of Voltaire.
Bomb doors open, skipper. Okay, bomb aimer. Steady, skipper. Left. Left. Steady. Right a bit. Steady. Steady. Bomb's gone.
S. Sugar bounced up in the air, relieved of her burden of bombs. No escape yet for them, though, as they had to carry on flying over the target, straight and level for another 30 seconds or so, while the photo flash flare dropped and the camera in the bomb bay shuttered and took the photograph. It was their proof that they had been on the bombing run. Without it, it might not count as an op. But God knows what anyone would see when they scrutinized the results, Teddy thought. There was complete cloud cover over the target, and add to that the sooty industrial miasma that permanently cloaked the Ruhr, and it could have been the surface of the moon down there for all they knew. They had bombed on sky markers laid down by the newly formed Pathfinder Force, and hoped for the best. Later, much later, after the war, when all the history books and memoirs and biographies started to come out, and people stopped wanting to forget the war and started wanting to remember it, Teddy had looked into this raid, and discovered that a large part of the force had bombed a place 10 miles west of the target, and on balance, probably more damage had been suffered by the bombers than by anyone on the ground. The more he read, the more he discovered how inaccurate their bombing had been in those earlier years. He had talked about this with Mac at the reunion dinner.
"What a waste," Teddy said. "A waste of bombs," Mac said.
Teddy supposed that, as a navigator, Mac felt personally slighted.
"Well, that wasn't really what I meant," Teddy demurred. "So many men and aircraft lost for so little result. We thought we were crippling their economy, but a lot of the time we were killing women and children."
"Can't believe you've joined the hand-wringers, Ted."
"I haven't," he protested.
"They started it, Ted," Mac said.
"And we finished it," Teddy thought. He was glad that he had sat out the last 18 months of the war in a POW camp, hadn't witnessed Bomber Command trying to remove Germany from the map of Europe. It was the backstop of every argument. They started it. They sowed the wind. They asked for it. The clichés thrown up by war.
"An eye for an eye," Max said. "And you can say what you like, Ted, but a good German is still a dead German."
All of them, Teddy wondered. Even now.
"I know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have bombed them," Teddy said, "but with hindsight."
"The question is, Ted, with all your so-called hindsight, would you do it again, if asked?"
He would. Of course he would. Auschwitz. Treblinka. But he didn't give Mac the satisfaction of an answer. The camera shuttered and Teddy banked S. Sugar away, and Mac set the course for the homeward leg.
"That wasn't so bad,"
the second Dickie said. Guy, wasn't it? Teddy wasn't sure. He seemed like a guy. Or was it Giles? Two or three voices groaned on the intercom. It was considered particularly bad luck to say a thing like that.
Long way to go yet, Teddy said.
And indeed, the flak was as bad, if not worse, on the way out as it had been on the way in. They could feel the blast from the AK-AK shells bursting all around them, and the jar and thud as splinters of flak hit the fuselage. There was a sudden blinding flash on the port side as a Lancaster was hit in the wing. The wing was blown off and sheared through the air under its own volition until it hurtled into another Lancaster, slicing off its mid-upper turret. Both Lancasters then spiraled down to earth, almost balletic in their fiery fall.
Fuck!
A horrified voice said over the intercom. Vic or George, Teddy wasn't sure. Fuck indeed, he thought silently. He sent Norman back to assess the flak damage.
Bloody big hole, he said.
They hardly needed telling this. There was an arctic gale blowing through Eshugar. Guy seemed to have changed his mind about how bad it was, and he indicated to Teddy that he was going to the back of the aircraft to acquaint himself with the unsavory Elsan. Guy went to Eton. Must remember, Teddy berated himself. The lost oddbod from Somerset had left him feeling guilty, derelict in his duty. Everyone on the aircraft was his responsibility, after all. The least he could do was to remember their names, for heaven's sake. Guy never came back, because at that moment both gunners started yelling down the intercom at once.
Fighter port quarter! Course crew port! Go!
And Teddy rammed the control column forward. But not before they were hit by cannon fire from a fighter, a great rattling like some sky god throwing stones at the fuselage. The stink of cordite fumes filled the aircraft. Teddy had thrown J-Jig into a steep dive, but by the time he had banked to starboard and started to climb back up, the fighter had gone, without Teddy ever having seen it. It didn't come back, disappearing as mysteriously as it had appeared. Max set a direct course for home, avoiding the heavily defended areas around Rotterdam and Amsterdam, but by the time they reached the Dutch coast, they were down to 2,000 feet. The fighter had done its work. The port and starboard inners were out, the starboard aileron gone, and 5 wing tanks were perforated. There was also a big gash in the fuselage. Teddy feathered the useless engines, and they persevered. Too late to turn back, as they had been flying through cloud, and when they finally came out of it, they were well over the North Sea. For a while, another straggling Halifax formatted with them. But they were flying so low and slow that their companion gave up on them and climbed away with a farewell waggle of her wings. They were alone. At 1,500 feet, Teddy told his crew to prepare for ditching. 10 miles to the English coast, he reported calmly.
Get us a bit closer, skipper, someone said.
The idea of ditching was bad enough, but to go down in the drink and be picked up by Germans was unthinkable.
Keep going, Norman pleaded. We made it back from Turin, remember?
At 1,000 feet they could see the white horses on the crests of the waves. 15, perhaps 20 foot high. Tempest-tossed, Teddy thought. By now they had jettisoned everything they could. The navigator's table, cushions, flasks, oxygen bottles. Keith attacked the seats with the axe to break them up, and Vic dismantled the mid-upper guns and threw them out of the aircraft, followed by the turret itself. Anything to keep them going that little bit longer.
4 miles to the English coast, Mac reported, his voice as calm as ever.
His papers and maps had flown all over the place when they had gone into the dive to evade the fighter, and now he was gathering them all together as if he was shutting down an office for the weekend. It was one thing not to panic, Teddy thought, but another to have no sense of urgency. He recalled how, when they were trying to extricate Kenny from the rear turret, Mac had stood back, commenting, while the others worked themselves into a frenzy.
"Keep going, skipper,"
another voice said. At 500 feet, George Carr clamped the Morse key down, set the IFF on the international distress frequency, and collected the dinghy wireless. At 400 feet, the fuel gauges read zero. They opened the escape hatches, and Teddy told everyone to assume ditching positions. Mac lay down in the starboard rest position, Norman on the port side, their feet braced against the front spar. The gunners had their backs to the rear spar, and George and Keith sat between their legs. They all placed their hands behind their necks or rested them on their parachute packs to absorb the shock. Teddy had drilled them well. They hit the water at 110 mph. The bomb aimer's compartment broke on impact, and a huge wave of water and petrol swept inside Es Sugar, immersing them up to their necks almost before they had time to inflate their May Wests. George had been knocked out on impact, and they manhandled him awkwardly through the escape hatch. It turned out that Kenny couldn't swim, and furthermore was terrified of water, and Mac had to secure him with one hand by the scruff and drag him through the water that had filled the fuselage while he thrashed about, squawking with fear. Teddy brought up the rear. A captain was always the last off the ship. The dinghy that was stowed in the wing had been inflated and was now blocking the overhead escape hatch. Es Sugar was almost completely full of water and beginning to roll to port. And for a moment, Teddy thought, this is it then. But then he kicked down into the water and swam through the gaping hole in the fuselage. They all made it out, and somehow or other they scrambled onto the dinghy. Norman cut the painter, and they floated away from Es Sugar. She was still afloat, bobbing lopsidedly in the unforgiving grey, but within minutes she was sucked down and lost to the world forever. Somewhere out in the dark, they could hear an engine. Mac grabbed for the very pistol and tried to fire off a cartridge, but his fingers were so swollen and numb with cold that he couldn't do it. How many hours had they been in the water? They had all lost track of time. This was their second night, they were all sure of that. It had quickly become apparent to them that the ditching was only the beginning of their problems. There had been a huge swell on the sea, and no sooner had they successfully made it into the dinghy than they were all pitched back into the sea again by an enormous wave. At least the dinghy had stayed the right way up, small mercies, but it had taken a tremendous, almost superhuman effort for them all to clamber back in again, not to mention having to haul the insensate George back as well. Vic had lost his boot somewhere along the way and was in agony with the cold. They all took it in turns to rub his feet, but their own hands had grown increasingly benumbed. Their clothes were completely waterlogged, and they were sodden through to the skin, intensifying their cold and misery a hundredfold. Poor concussed George Carr was propped up awkwardly, but kept slipping down into the water on the floor of the dinghy. He was semi-conscious, but moaning a lot. It was hard to say whether or not he was in pain, but Mac gave him a shot of morphine anyway, and he grew quiet. The dinghy wireless had been lost when they were washed into the sea, and who knew how far they had drifted from their original ditching position. The chances of an aircraft spotting them, or a rescue launch finding them, seemed remote. The sound of the engine had faded altogether by the time one of them, Norman, managed to pull the trigger on the very pistol, and Key said, "Too fucking late." The cartridge served only to illuminate the vast darkness that they were adrift in, and if possible lowered their spirits even further. Teddy wondered if they had hallucinated the aircraft engine. Perhaps it was like being lost in the desert, and soon they would see mirages or become prey to all sorts of deceptions and delusions.
"I'd give anything for a coffin nail," Keith said. "I did have a packet of fags," Kenny said, struggling to produce them from his pocket.
They regarded the wet woodbines with regret before they were tossed over the side. All the emergency supplies had gone, of course. Cigarettes, food, and anything that might have cheered or sustained them had been washed away when they had been submerged a second time. Teddy found a piece of chocolate in a pocket, and Mac divided it up scrupulously with his penknife and divvied up the fragments. George had been right to eat his chocolate ration before they took off, Teddy thought. He was beyond caring now. Vic refused the chocolate. He was suffering terribly with seasickness.
"I've heard all those tales," Keith said, "of men drifting at sea for weeks in an open boat, and how they end up eating each other, starting with the cabin boy."
They all instinctively turned to look at Kenny.
"But I just want to let you know, I'd rather eat my own foot than any of you buggers."
"I feel personally insulted," Max said. "I'd make any man a good meal."
That set them all off talking about food, which is never a good idea when there is no possibility of any. But gradually the talk subsided and died away. They were too exhausted for conversation, and one by one they fell into fitful sleep. Teddy worried that they might not wake from this cold slumber.